Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 230, I have a distinct pleasure being joined by Dr. Mark Spurn and Ms. Amy Safko. Ms. Safko is a layperson who emailed me. She is the mother of retina patients. She actually reached out to me because she wanted to discuss pediatric retina surgery, recovery from retina surgery in kids, and Stickler syndrome, which her kids suffer from. And she gave us permission to talk about this on the podcast. We recorded this a while back, and I'm recording this intro on April 22nd, 2020. This podcast will come out on the 27th of April. We'd had to push it back because of COVID-19 and other developments. But hopefully you'll find it enjoyable. It's a very unique perspective to have the two of them kind of talk about their interaction and managing pediatric retina patients. And it will be educational. None of us have any relevant financial disclosures. That's listed in the episode description. Also in the episode description, you'll see a link to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website to claim CME for this podcast and other podcast episodes. Thank you to everyone who came out to the VitBuckle 8 online virtual series part 1, which was on April 20th at 8:30 Eastern. We will have another event in June on June 24th, 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Save that date and wait for more information on that. That should be a great program. We had over 870 people log in at some point and pretty much 750 plus for most of the evening. So it was a great, great evening. We will plan to release a recording of that at some point and with attached CME, so stay tuned for that as well. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by a special two-guest combo. We have Dr. Mark Spurn, who is a partner at Mid-Atlantic Retina and a retina attending at Wills Eye Hospital based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Dr. Spurn, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jay. Thanks for having me.
And then we have Mrs. Amy Safko, who is a patient who actually reached out to me. She is the founder of a social media group for patients, focusing on patients with retinal detachments and retinal conditions. Mrs. Safko, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So this was a wonderful episode idea, actually, and I have to give you, Mrs. Safko, full credit for bringing up the idea of kind of speaking a little bit again from the patient perspective. We've done this before. We had one patient come on with Dr. Alan Ho from Wills Eye Hospital, and now Mrs. Safko, who is not a patient, but the mother of retina patients, here to talk a little bit about, kind of the doctor-patient relationship and their perspective. So just to give the listeners a little bit of background, I'll let Dr. Spurn go first. Dr. Spurn, a little background on why you became an ophthalmologist and then a retina specialist.
Sure, Jay. So let's see, I've been an ophthalmologist at Wills Eye for about 11 years, part of Mid-Atlantic Retina. I guess originally I went into ophthalmology. I grew up in a household where my father was a comprehensive ophthalmologist. Growing up, I saw a lot of what ophthalmology had to offer. Why I went into retina, once I got to college, I ended up majoring in neurobiology and sort of fell in love with the interaction with the eye and the brain, and being someone who's a little bit hands-on and like someone who wanted to do surgery, that sort of drew me into retina.
And then, Mrs. Safko, a little background on you and how you end up listening to our podcast, and a little bit about why you founded a social media group for patients.
Okay. I was kind of brought into the retina world by my kids because we have a diagnosis of Stickler syndrome in our family. We went through the surgeries, many surgeries, and the all the things that occur afterwards, complications that can happen, things would crop up or whatever. And time went on and we got out of crisis mode. And I was being monitored because I have the syndrome. And my son in 2017, he's now 13 years old, but in 2017, he had a detachment in his left eye and then re-detached a few times and then again in 2018. So I've kind of seen a lot of different parts to retinal detachment surgery, things that occur afterwards. I am a curious person by nature, you know, had to do a lot of learning about the anatomy of the eye because I was definitely not an expert in that. But like in terms of just getting advice and things like that from people who maybe have been there, there wasn't a lot out there. There was one public group on Facebook, but I really wanted to protect my daughter's privacy as much as possible. And I really didn't want my questions that I was asking to be seen by family and friends. So I just decided to create a private group that people could search for. They just can't see the posts unless they're actually in the group. And it has been a wonderful thing. I feel like it's been a good resource for people over the years. It's now got over 6,800 people and from all over the world. So it's interesting hearing different perspectives of what is done in different areas and access to care, that kind of stuff. But so yeah, that it was really, you know, I created the group partly for my own needs, but then I just saw people just kept wanting to join, and they really feel like it's been a help, you know, to them in terms of dealing with the things that, you know, that come up, maybe more like anxiety, that kind of stuff.
And before, I want to ask you more about the group. Dr. Spurn, Ms. Safko talked about, a little bit about her experiences with Stickler syndrome. In addition to adult patients, you take care of pediatric patients, and you do see patients with syndromes such as Stickler's. For listeners, residents, or uninformed non-medical listeners who may be listening, tell us a little bit about Stickler syndrome. What sort of things do patients experience? What sort of findings would you find as the physician? And what sort of counseling do you give for a family that has a patient with Stickler syndrome?
Sure. So Stickler syndrome is one of the hereditary connective tissue disorders that causes an abnormal collagen formation. Typically, most families we see have sort of an autosomal dominant inheritance pattern. So you know, affected individuals, 50% of their children will have the autosomal dominant gene that codes for Stickler syndrome. There are some autosomal recessive forms, although at least in my experience, we tend to see more autosomal dominant families coming in with this condition. Typically, they get diagnosed in one of several ways. So, you know, as we heard here, I mean, one of the ways that we often see will be children coming in with bilateral detachments where maybe, you know, one eye wasn't picked up, and then when the second eye goes, we'll see sort of bilateral detachments in the first identified family member. Sometimes we see families that come in where a parent knows about it because they had a detachment as a young child. The average age of detachments probably between like 11 and 12 in this group. So, you know, we sometimes see them in younger patients, but 11 or 12 is probably, I would say, average. But patients with Stickler syndrome can present in, you know, in different ways. So there's different variations of Stickler syndrome. There are some forms that just affect the eye. There are some that affect the eye and different parts of the body. And then there's types of Stickler syndrome that just affect the body. But sort of the most common, where it affects both the body and the eye, we can see different facial features, like we can see cleft lips and cleft palates. They can get a tongue that's displaced posteriorly. Mid-face hypoplasia is pretty common. They get joint abnormalities like joint laxity, kyphoscoliosis. Later on, they can develop arthritis at an early age. Some of these patients will develop hearing loss or heart valve abnormalities like mitral valve prolapse. And then if sometimes those features can be what leads to the diagnosis, you know, either by the pediatrician or the family doc. But then when they end up seeing their eye care professional, you know, things that we often see with Stickler syndrome include myopia. They can develop early onset cataracts, usually like a lamellar type cataract. They're at risk for glaucoma. probably from like an anterior segment dysgenesis. And then, you know, typically the most important thing is their risk for retinal detachment. So about 50% of these patients with Stickler syndrome will go on to develop a retinal detachment. And the things we see in the retina would be, you know, the big thing would be an optically empty vitreous, where they can get either like a membranous or beaded vitreous. They tend to get perivascular lattice, oftentimes, which is pretty posterior. And unlike, you know, non-Stickler eyes, they tend to develop pretty early onset vitreous synaresis, which can lead to PVDs and GRTs, often at a pretty young age. So these are a little unlike other types of retinal detachments in young patients, which are usually formed from lattice degeneration with atrophic holes. These patients can really come in with pretty complicated retinal detachments, either because of the posterior insertion of the vitreous base, the perivascular lattice, or, you know, in some cases, the giant retinal tears. And they also often present with bilateral disease. So in some patients, you're treating one eye and deciding if you need to prophylactically do something in the other eye. So, you know, usually when we're counseling the patients early on, it really depends on their clinical situation. Many times we'll see these patients with bilateral detachments. And so we're trying to decide which eye is the best eye to approach first, you know, which eye is going to have the better visual potential. And, you know, unfortunately, because of all these complex factors, it's not unusual to require more than one surgery. So, you know, oftentimes we end up having to put silicone oil in, which eventually necessitates removing the silicone oil. It can also lead to, you know, worsening of their cataracts. So these are sort of complicated surgical situations. And, you know, getting the parents to understand that this isn't typically a one surgery and we're done type thing, like it may be in adults. You know, this can be sort of a prolonged journey that can take a couple of years in some cases, and then, you know, follow up through the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great summary. And I think that part about the counseling at the end is really, really important to kind of have that conversation up front. Ms. Safo, you know, I think that even for adults who have detachments and even in one eye that has a single surgery, recovery can be really, really difficult. And now we're talking about a scenario where you have children who are having detachments and things in both eyes and multiple procedures. And there's, I mean, you can speak a little bit to the challenges. I mean, I think recovery is hard for anybody from retinal detachment. For a kid, it's got to be super challenging.
Yes. It's ironic because kids are so resilient too, that if for each of my kids, their recoveries were different in terms of how they preferred, like, positioning. They both had to do face down positioning. One, we had a massage table somebody loaned us. For face down positioning, he preferred the table, whereas my daughter, we had to kind of come up with some ways for her to be comfortable. She was in a different situation because it was both her eyes. Her surgeries were a week apart. So it was a much longer period of time that she was having to do face down positioning. And it's a challenge. The nice part is, I mean, there are a lot of technology things that we can take advantage of. Even just, you know, playing audiobooks while they lay there. We've been able to kind of come up with ways to prop things for them to see underneath when they're doing face down positioning to keep them busy. But it's, I will say, like, they're both very active kids, but at the same time, the surgery takes a lot out of them. And they were not rushing to get up and move around a lot. So that did help. It's definitely, you know, there are times when I look at, you know, what they were going through and I can't believe they tolerated it as well as they did. But I think sometimes when you're put in that position, you know, the kids kind of rise to the challenge too. So I think one thing that was hard as a parent are things like trying to figure out when it's time to call the doctor because they say something is strange. They see something funny. When they're that young, the way they describe it, there were times when I was calling the doctor and saying, I can remember my daughter saying, I see this strange tree outline in my line of vision. I had no idea what that meant. I didn't know if it was something to be concerned about. I didn't, and so for a long time, I was on guard a lot and trying to kind of figure out, okay, is this an emergency or not? Do I need to take her in? And the one thing I will say is, to be told by your doctor, anytime something changes, just give us a call. That really helped because I was never made to feel like I was being an imposition or being a problem patient or anything like that. It was definitely always are on the side of caution. And that helped me as a parent to not feel like, I had to figure it all out myself. Mm.
Dr. Spurn, from your perspective, operating on children, what sort of modifications do you do to things like that, to counseling about symptoms, post-op drops, positioning? I mean, obviously it depends on the age of a child, but what do you do, for example, for a child who's, 5 or 4 versus a child who's 10 or 11? It's going to be a little different. I mean, do you ever do different things like give subteen on steroids, understanding that maybe the drops won't get in, or what sort of modifications do you do?
I don't know that I make any huge modifications, based on age. Parents are pretty innovative, and I think, usually I don't hear too many stories of I couldn't get the drops in or things like that. I mean, sometimes we'll make modifications in really young kids, in terms of maybe suture placement or types of suture we're using. We may use dissolvable sutures instead of, an adult, we may use a suture that we can remove in the office. Positioning, I think, has become easier nowadays with, a lot of the new technologies, whether it's the iPad. And, when I first started, people were using these face down equipment and they'd have mirrors to look at the TV across the hall. And I feel like now with an iPad, it's still not a lot of fun to keep your face down for a few days, but it's certainly become easier. And, there's a lot of games that kids can play. And, I think anything that can keep them looking down, in the really, really, really young kids, it can be a little bit of a challenge, the kids under 1 or 2, but, probably that's not our sticklers individuals. I don't know that I make a huge change. Sometimes we'll use maybe Maxitrol drops. We might use a combination drop in the really young kids or kids that just can't get the drops in. But I don't think those drops work quite as well as, whether it's prednisolone or Durezol for the steroids. The steroid effect is better. Yeah, to separate them, I think, is helpful. And these kids are at really high risk of, proliferative vitreoretinopathy and inflammatory reactions. So it's nice to get, I think, a good steroid on board. I'm not really opposed to using subtenons steroids, but I think usually I just don't find it that necessary as long as the parents are pretty good about getting the drops in.
That's helpful. Just to close, you guys have been super generous with your time. Mrs. Safko, you mentioned the group you started for patients and how you started it. So I think Dr. Spur and I would be most interested, because these are patients speaking to other patients, what's kind of the most common questions that patients have? Like, what are the things that people want to know that they maybe didn't quite understand that was explained to them, or they didn't get the complete answer they wanted? So maybe as physicians, we can do a better job explaining certain things.
Mm-hmm. Something I hear a lot of is questions about the oil versus the gas. Every case is unique. There's always like extenuating circumstances for each case. And so it's always best to go to your doctor. However, they will ask things like, why would my surgeon have chosen the oil versus the gas? They oftentimes are questioning. And that's when I'm always repeating, trust your doctor. But it's, the position, the length of time for positioning. Sometimes they get confused. A lot of them, I actually put out a question to them about like, what would you want your surgeon to know, or like from your experience? And the biggest thing that came up was communication. Just making sure that they are getting an understanding of, especially the short-term and long-term impact afterwards. I think what I see a lot of is people think it will be, you know, okay, they fix the detachment and, you know, that's it. And they don't realize that there is a lot more sometimes that is involved. And, you know, to kind of be prepared for the long haul. It's not that it's going to be awful the whole time. Just know that, you know, there are things that have to be taken care of later. And I never had that issue because doctors, well, you know, he's, you know, was very thorough with explaining everything every step of the way. You know, that was probably the big thing that really came out of what they talk about, is just feeling, you know, making sure that people, that there's an open line of communication there. A lot of people, and this is something that was really, that they felt really needed to be stressed, was the amount of anxiety and the potential for mental health issues to come up afterwards. That, not to say that the surgeon should be, you know, dealing with that end of it necessarily, but maybe refer, you know, that, you know, if anxiety does become an issue, you know, perhaps seek professional help, to, you know, to work through, because depending on the situation, sometimes, you know, it's very traumatic, and, that they weren't, a lot of them were not prepared for that. So I think that knowing that, you know, it's, that there may be, some, you know, feelings that come up that you're not expecting, whether it's worry. I think that's a lot of it, is just not knowing what could happen next. And until time passes, that really doesn't necessarily get ease up at all. Because I think the longer you go, when things are become more stable, then you start to feel better, and you know, you can move on. But there's a period of time afterwards. So just I think maybe communicating that to patients, that may happen.
No, that's a great point. And you know, Dr. Spurn is one of my teachers, and I think I've kind of followed with you and a lot of the other attendings to talk about. I think there's a couple key points there. I think for Mrs. Safko and for patients, I think one of the reasons it can be confusing for patients, gas versus oil or positioning, is because I think there's a lot of controversy within retina. And I think different surgeons do different things in different scenarios, and people disagree on some of these things. And there's not necessarily clear evidence for every situation, how long to position in a certain way, or whether gas or oil is more appropriate for a certain situation. There's a lot of personal variability there. But I think the point about patients being confused, I think one of the things I learned from you, Dr. Spurn, is not only being thorough, but certain things need to be repeated, because I think you can be given a lot of information before surgery, but I think there's a lot of other things going through your head. You may not remember everything that's told to you before you're taken, for example, for an urgent retinal detachment surgery, your child's taken for surgery. And so kind of repeating some of the critical points, you know, after the surgery multiple times to kind of reinforce them. I think it's too much to ask maybe for everyone to remember everything that's said in a pre-op visit.
I think that's so important. The one thing that was really helpful to us was, I mean, I'll be quite honest, when I think I was lost the minute I heard she needed surgery the next day. And from my perspective, it was not just the panic of what was happening and not knowing and what the prognosis would be. There were logistical things. I had to get her to her pediatrician to get clearance for the surgery the next morning. And then I had two other young children who needed to get picked up off the bus, and I needed and my mind was just racing. And then, so I got home and I had all these questions. I did not sleep much that night, did a lot of looking online, but I know where I don't overdo it with looking online, but just enough to familiarize myself with terminology. Then the next morning, prior to surgery, being asked, you know, do you have any questions now, and you know, or any concerns, and again repeating what was going to be done, and what, you know, what we didn't know going in, what could happen. That kind of stuff, it was so helpful to me.
Dr. Spurn, any closing thoughts or kind of on that statement, or anything else you'd like to say before we close?
No, I mean, not really, but I definitely agree with you. And I mean, that's definitely something that I try to incorporate into my practice. I think, you know, repetition is key, whether it's before surgery or after surgery, because, you know, especially with these situations where you're dealing with kids and parents, you know, there's a lot of emotional, there's a large emotional component that you don't always see with adult surgery. But even in adult surgery, when we're doing, you know, more what we would consider routine surgery, you know, very frequently I have patients after surgery say, oh, I don't remember you saying that. And, you know, so I repeat, you know, how long it's going to take to get your vision better. And, you know, I frequently repeat things just to remind patients that they've heard it before. And it always surprises me, because I have a pretty similar routine when I talk about, you know, similar surgeries, of which parts people remember and forget. And it varies by patient, but, you know, it's helpful to repeat these things because it sort of gives patients and families a little bit of a roadmap, you know, that they can sort of look forward to, and, you know, how long is the oil going to be in, and, you know, possibly we may have to exchange the oil or things like that, just depending on how they recover. But these, you know, these are complex cases, and, you know, it takes your entire team to sort of get them doing well. But they can be very rewarding in the end.
Well, Dr. Mark Spurn and Mrs. Amy Sapko, really, I really appreciate both of you taking the time to do this on a weekday night. I know you both have children and family, so our listeners appreciate you talking with us. And Mrs. Sapko, thank you again for reaching out and for the group that you're providing a lot of support to patients out there. So thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Jess. Have a great night, guys. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
As always, you can find this podcast and other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 230 episodes, including this one, can be found there, sorted by category. You also find links to subscribe to our mailing list that will give you updates on the most recent episodes. You can also subscribe in the Apple Podcast or Android Podcast app on your mobile device. We're on Facebook and on Twitter. And to reach out to us, please hit the contact us link on our website or email me at retinapodcast@gmail.com. In general, I have to say that we've been really grateful to all the support and feedback we've gotten, the ideas we've gotten during this crisis. Hopefully, as we move forward, the pandemic continues to improve. We've learned a lot of lessons, all of us. And again, thank you to all of you who have served and have helped out during this crisis. Thanks to Dr. Mark Spurn and Ms. Amy Sapko for coming on and for joining this episode. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Benicasa for helping with the production and social media for this episode. And again, thank you, providers, for all that you do, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.